6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lore cast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect Lorecast. I'm In7 the Legend.
And I'm Genesis. Join us
as we explore along tides of light
and through shoals of dust
to see where this lore began
and consider where it may go.
Spectres, welcome back to another episode of the Mass Effect Lorecast. I am your host, In7 the Legend, and joining me as always is Genesis.
Hello, hello. Feels good to be back.
It does. And are we really back, though? Because we're being directly controlled.
I am assuming direct control.
And we're receiving our orders. We may call them Reapers, but they call themselves our salvation. Demand that we talk about their arrival.
Nice play on words there.
Thank
Very
you.
Nice. Thank Kudos you. And snaps.
It's a little bit of a dad joke for the newly minted dad.
All right, you only get three per episode, so wow. There's one right. So far.
Like 40 seconds in, and I've already burned my first dad joke card. All right, well, I'll have to scrap the whole second half, but we can go forward with it anyway. But of course, we are talking about the Arrival DLC.
Yeah, so for me, I'm excited to talk about this one because I know that there is a lot of lore about Arrival that completely blew past me. And mainly because it's like, I know that I wasn't stopping to read a whole lot of the data pads. I wasn't listening to the recordings. Or if I was, I was hitting it and then running into the next room anyways. I know. I am a horrible lore master on that. That the fact that on a couple of playthroughs, I just blew through stuff.
Yes. But boo.
You know what? I'm taking the time to learn now, and I'm taking the time to read and listen, because over the last few days, I played through the entire Arrival DLC. Just like I reloaded an old save and went through, and I was like, I'm going to play this so that way I know exactly how it plays through. And because the first three or four playthroughs that I did, I didn't have the Arrival DLC because I was playing OG Trilogy version and didn't have the DLC. So a lot of the lore was missed for me. And I've really only done it like once or twice on Legendary Edition. And I know that I missed a lot of details on that too. So I'm excited to learn right along with you.
This is, I have always played the Arrival DLC with every playthrough I've done. I think maybe only once I missed it, and that was because it was Neutral Shep who didn't do any of the DLCs, because that would open up the possibility of him becoming less neutral. I am very excited to talk about this because I also discovered some lore, and we're going to talk about it right here, of this little known element that leads directly up to the Arrival DLC. And we're also going to start addressing some of the moral dilemmas a little bit later in this episode that we face in the DLC on whether to eliminate hundreds of thousands of people to save potentially more. And then we're going to get into some lingering questions that we have about Hackett's involvement. Before we get started, though, I did want to call out that this episode is brought to you all by our Reaper tier patron, hence the assuming direct control and the Reaper sound effects there at the beginning. Our Reaper tier patron, Commander Shrinky Shep, has generously decided to extend his support into April. So this is the topic that Commander Shrinky Shep wanted to hear about, and we'll get into some of his direct questions a little bit later. But Jen, why don't we get started?
Yeah, so you mentioned that there's some background lore and little known. Is there secret arrival lore that we need to talk about first?
Yeah, there is. And you know how we love those storylines that we get through CDN or Cerberus Daily News? They used to be, back in the day, these were updates that came through directly to the terminal in Mass Effect 2. And if I'm not mistaken, it was on the main menu. I think there was also a companion app that may have given you these as well. I read them on the wiki. That's just how I read them. But there was a Cerberus Daily News entry released on the same day that the Arrival DLC was released. And I found this really fascinating. Of course, it's a little bit of marketing spin to just kind of hype up the DLC, but they didn't need to go this detailed with it. So we'll break this up a little bit, but just take a listen to this Cerberus Daily News entry released along with the DLC. Here's how it starts. Historians and astronomers alike are abuzz tonight over a new paper published by Dr. Amanda Kinson of the University of Arcturus. Little context here, Arcturus Station, that's where the Alliance Parliament is held. Her team claims that by testing the dust trapped in the gravity wells around a mass relay and comparing its composition to that of the dust clouds in the same system, scientists can create a timeline of when the relay passed through the dust. Her conclusion? Quote unquote, only a small fraction of the Mass Effect relays date back 50,000 years, she writes. The majority are far older, indicating that they were created by a species predating even the Protheans. So, okay, this is a big deal. This is someone in-universe besides Shepard stumbling upon this fact that the relays are older than the Protheans. But then not everyone is really willing to accept this finding right away. We have Dr. Arana, I think is how you'd say that. Arana. Dr. Arana Tamelis of the University of Ceres met the information with skepticism. She says, while Dr. Kinson's methods appear sound, the Asari tried a similar procedure centuries ago and discounted it. What civilization could have spanned the galaxy for thousands, for not thousands, but millions of years? If this were the case, we should have found mountains of evidence of their passing. Where is this species now? I know, eye roll. I love the way that they wrote in this scientific explanation for how somebody in the Mass Effect universe without direct knowledge discovered the relays were older than the Protheans. These kinds of details, specifically about comparing the dust trapped in the gravity wells of a mass relay and comparing that with the dust clouds in the same system, these details are what makes this sci-fi universe so alive.
Absolutely. And I love that. I mean, I never would have thought about testing dust particles to figure out the age and composition of something. That level of science is, it's sound and it sounds great. And I really, really like this detail. But the other part of this to me is there are the Asaris again, thinking that they are better than everyone. Oh, you did your research centuries ago. Right, because no technological advances have happened since then, and no other species would have a different methodology or ways of thinking to find data that you did not. Ew, the Asaris sometimes make me very, very frustrated.
It's very paternalistic from the Asari. very much, we covered this while you were not in class. Okay, so get with the program, human. It's so belittling. But regardless of that, I find that this difference of age of relays is fascinating. She doesn't just find out that some of the relays are older than the Protheans. Some of them are newer. So it's not like all of the relays were created all at once and have been there for even, you know, it's not like all of them are older than, you know, a million years old. Some of them are relatively new. So that suggests to me that the Reapers are still building on their process of the cycle, that more and more are constructed each cycle, and they're still tinkering with how to manipulate this experiment to better control organics and their evolution.
I agree, and it's a very interesting topic. The relays are being built or rebuilt each cycle, opening more and more of the universe to its inhabitants, and therefore to the Reaper's Harvest. Maybe they do have universal conquest in mind and are trying to gauge how many systems they can reach in each cycle. There has to be a method to their way that they're placing these.
It could also be by virtue of different species becoming more and more advanced over time, because not every species is harvested every time. So if one species that they let pass the last cycle all of a sudden becomes qualified to be harvested the next cycle, maybe they're trying to add a relay there so that they can get in time quickly enough in order to reap them. Or rather, maybe they just want to be able to manipulate their interactions with the galaxy at large more easily. So regardless, it's a pretty interesting thing because it illustrates the Reaper's process is fluid. It's not like they came up with all of this a long time ago and that was that, and every single time it's been the same way since. Yeah, some patterns probably repeat as we hear, but we're also finding that there are anomalies that must be popping up because the Reapers are reacting to them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
agreed.
Very fascinating there. I also find it, Tomelis's argument, we're discussing how it's a little condescending. There's a big fallacy in her argument, which is basically she's saying, well, we don't already know about this, so it must not exist. We don't already know about some kind of precursor race before the Protheans that built these relays. We don't already know about them, so they must not exist. And this hubris is totally characteristic of the Asari. That, you know, if they don't already know it, they're surely not going to be told so by the humans, you know, this jumpstart race.
Yes, this little jumpstart race. Again, it leads back to that hubris and the we must know everything because we've been here the whole time. We are the smartest race. And that's just the side of Asari that it's very interesting. It's well written because it flows throughout the entire trilogy and even into Andromeda that this is what the Asari people generally are like. And so it's good that even in this Cerberus news, the Asari are playing the character.
So the next Cerberus Daily News update kind of brings that Asari hubris to its knees, because in the very next update, it says Dr. Arana Tomelis's office in downtown Cerberus was broken into last night after she made galactic news for supporting the controversial study that claims mass relays predate the Protheans. So all of a sudden, she apparently had this change of heart. And she says, I don't understand, said a flabbergasted Dr. Tomelis. All they stole was research done by Dr. Kinson earlier this year. If they'd waited a month, they could have read it all in a published paper. Gee, Dr. Tomelis, why didn't they wait to read it in a published paper? Security footage shows four Batarians dressed in civilian clothing breaking into Dr. Tomelis' office at 4:13 a.m. local Thessia Standard Time. Skin cells from the scene identified one burglar as Palash Tarn, a former member of the Karshan military's Batarian Special Intervention Unit. No officials from Karshan were available to comment.
Ooh, okay. So now the Batarians have gone in and stolen the research. This is interesting. It's interesting on several different levels because, one, what do the Batarians want with it? Two, what are the Batarians even doing outside of their space? Oh,
right. Right. Yeah. Something happened. And now that Asari has come around to Kinson's conclusion. But then immediately afterward, that research goes missing because it's the Batarians. And why are they out of their system? When I read this, the first thing I was reminded of was the planet card where we learn about the Leviathan of Dis. It's actually a quote-unquote dead Reaper, and one of the Batarians decides to hold it in the highest levels of state secrets. The strong implication over the course of the games becomes that the Batarian leaders were indoctrinated thereafter from that Reaper. And so, of course, it's the Batarian Spec Ops unit that carries out this clandestine action to make sure that no one suspects that the whole relay system is a giant experiment older than the Protheans. The Reapers apparently are very invested in this myth of having people believe that it was the Protheans, or perhaps before the Protheans, the Inusandan, but that it was the precursor race of the previous cycle who built those. And they don't want people poking around and asking too many questions.
Right. And it's also note how rare it is to see the Batarian state forces carry out any official action outside of Karshan at all. So you know that this means a lot to them, whether it means a lot to them because it's a Batarian secret that they want to keep, or if the Reapers are telling them that this is something that they need to pay attention to.
Right. They're famously authoritarian, but they're also quite skilled at using other gangs and clans and other groups to carry out their dirty work for plausible deniability. So to use their own state forces is really a statement there. Okay, there is a third Cerberus Daily News entry that's released the very next day, and it is the final one of this little story arc leading up to Arrival. It says, reactions to the discovery that mass relays were not created by the Prothean civilization continue to pour in. On Kage, the response is largely denial and shock. Religious leader Albright Olos X, the Sunaril of the Manas tradition, reacted by uploading a 13-minute speech to the news nets that urged calm and peace. Quote, it is no heresy to say... Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on. Let me do my Hanar voice. It is no heresy to say the enkindlers themselves may have been enkindled, the Hanar said. It is their example of selflessness, courtesy, and willingness to share their gifts that teaches these ones how to live. To say there was something before them, an even more noble being, gives these penitents an even swifter current to ride, a greater model to which we can all aspire.
Very well done.
Thank you.
That was a very good Hanar.
I try to mimic the cadence and the inflections that I think it's Mark Meer, right? Mark Meer voices the Hanar? Yeah.
Mark Meer voices all Hanar. Yeah.
So, well, thank you. But yeah, as Day Zero here in chat says, that was a lot of words to say absolutely nothing. But it is funny that the public is reacting to this news, even though the research was stolen, the original research. And you got to think, okay, so how is the public even aware of this discovery that that at least some of the relays were older than the Protheans? Well, it's because the scientists must have taken that info to the press. And that is the power of journalism, baby. You gotta love it.
Oh, yeah. So what about the way that the Hanars are talking about this? They seem like, okay, well, of course, we still need to honor and work with the enkindlers on this, right?
I guess they're kind of moving the goalposts. It reminds me of how human religions reacted in the Mass Effect universe when the Mars archives were revealed, that we weren't alone, and that kicked off FTL travel. And it just kind of reminds me of how human religions moved the goalposts there. Though this is getting another inside look about Hanar religion, right? We don't often hear directly about Hanar religion. Like, what is this Sunaril of the Manas tradition? I have no idea. That's not really expounded upon, you know?
It's not. And I really want to learn more about the Hanar religion, because the line of the enkindlers may have been enkindled, that kind of sparked something. It shifted my thoughts about the Hanar religion, because I've always thought of it being about worshiping the Protheans, because they were a great people before they all died off randomly and for no reason. But we know from Javik that they were the main fighting race back against the Reapers. I mean, if we can trust his biased story, but that's fine. But what if the ideas that the Hanar are preaching about are actually the Reaper ideals? It is no heresy to say that the indoctrinators themselves may have been indoctrinated.
I always viewed enkindle, like the verb enkindle, to mean to send up in flames.
Or to be enlightened.
Perhaps to be enlightened, to be ascended, to be something like that. Yeah, I always kind of viewed it that they were worshiping the enkindlers as people who uplifted others. The Protheans uplifting the Hanar, right? With the, I think they gave the Hanar the gift of language, right?
Possibly.
That's kind of my notes. I didn't double check that.
Yeah, but I mean, there was the Hanar that was so easily swayed by the Reapers to deploy that virus, and the way that they all want to follow the Prothean way. But we know that a lot of Protheans were indoctrinated because we have the collectors. So,
and
I don't know.
Not just the collectors, but traitors, as Javik puts them. So, yeah, I don't know. It's really interesting. Ultimately, maybe Day Zero in chat was right here when he said there was a lot of words to mean nothing. Maybe it's literally just a Hanar preacher trying to keep up with the news and putting out a lot of prose that doesn't really make sense but sounds great, and it doesn't look like he's panicking and renouncing his beliefs. So maybe it's all to save face. And as we know, with Hanar culture, they have multiple faces, right? Multiple names that they only reveal to different people depending on how close they are. So clearly pride is an important element with the Hanar culture. Who knows? But that really leads us into the story of the Arrival DLC. In Mass Effect 2, we are at the Normandy's galaxy map, and Tackett calls us, which is highly unusual for Mass Effect 2, given that we've kind of cut ties with the Alliance largely, and we are currently with Cerberus. So it is a little bit odd that Hackett would call us, especially to say that he needs to talk privately, right? So we go up to our captain's quarters to take the call from Hackett. And here is what he tells us that this is all about. Let's have a listen, shall we?
Commander, thank you for your time. I'll keep this brief. We have a deep cover operative out in Batarian space. Name's Dr. Amanda Kenson. Dr. Kenson recently reported that she found evidence of an imminent Reaper invasion.
So why call me?
Just this morning I received word that the Batarians arrested her. They're holding her in a secret prison outpost on terrorism charges. I need you to infiltrate the prison and get her out of there. As a favor to me, I'm asking you to go in alone.
Okay, so that's the little preface that Hackett gives us, and thank you to Gamer's Little Playground for that short clip right there. But I did want to talk about this because we can explore a little bit of options here with Hackett to try and get a little bit more information. But Jin, as you know, you just played through it like last night and the night before that. He doesn't give us a ton of information.
No, we're basically on a personal favor for him. And that's all he really wants to tell us, is that it's there. We've got to go rescue her. It's got to be somebody that doesn't really have current alliance ties.
Yeah, it's like if Hackett were in The Sopranos and he's like, hey, Commander, listen, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. We all end up a little bit happier.
Capiche? I need a favor. I need a favor from you, Shepard.
Yeah, exactly. So we learn, we can probe him a little bit, pun intended, and we can learn that Kinsen is a top scientist and this alliance agent, actually, that was working in Batarian space. But the interesting thing is that Hackett says the assignment is deadly and she is one of few that can actually handle the job. That's interesting because Hackett calls this a job or assignment for Kinsen, and that she is an alliance agent, because he also tells us a little bit later in the same conversation, this is not an official mission. It's just one person going in to rescue a friend. I believe that's how he puts it. So which is it, Hackett? Is it that Kinsen is working as an alliance agent and this was an assignment of hers, or this is not an official mission and you're just going in to rescue a friend? Which is it here, Hackett? I don't know. For me, it clearly looks like this is already a cover your ass kind of moment for Hackett and the Alliance, because no one, it looks like no one, not even Shepard, is allowed to actually know that this was a real Black Ops mission. And now he's like going in for the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah. And I don't think that we ever really get a solid answer on that, on whether or not it was a true alliance mission, or if this sounds a little bit more Mass Effect 1 Cerberus-y Black Ops that splintered off.
Ooh, I never thought of it that way. Of course, I do know what happens if you don't do this DLC, what the lore fills in that hole with, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. It doesn't involve the Alliance's 103rd Marine Division, so I think that's enough to tell us that this was definitely an Alliance mission, but no one was allowed to know about it. So anyway, regardless, he tells us that Hackett tells us that Hackett and Kinsen go back a long time, and he's not going to let her rot away in this prison camp, right? So then that kind of kicks us off toward going to this Batarian prison camp on the planet Eritot. In the Bahawk system. And that's where we're supposed to rescue Kinsen. Now, Jin, you just played through this recently, and I know that you took notes while you were playing through it.
I did, and this is going to be a little bit of an insight into how my brain works, because I free flow wrote down every little thought that I had that popped up while playing through this. So it starts off with, ooh, I haven't played ME2 on my new PC yet, and ooh, she looks pretty. Planet card, Eritot, probably will be reading this later. 90k free, 215k other. So that was based off of the population on the planet itself. There were 90,000 people free, 215,000 people enslaved. Breakout, Dr. Amanda Kinsen. Rando Batarian reference, slamming ass, haha. Running comm interference. I wonder if Hackett was doing that too. Is this how he got the info? Either way, she was smuggling engines and guidance systems to the Bahawk system from Omega. But the interrogations just led to random ramblings. She must be going crazy. Meet Kinsen. Ooh, she hardcore hacker. Let's get this. Brutal shuttle fire, Shep. That was rude. They are invested in Reaper tech. What are you doing? Talking about the Alpha Relay? That you have proof that the Reapers exist? Woman, what are you getting into?
And that's a good... I was going to say that's a good point to jump in and say that we do learn, of course, that Kinsen is indoctrinated from working too closely to this Reaper artifact, the one that she was supposed to be studying, and Kinsen is actively trying to circumvent the Alliance's plans to take out the Alpha Relay. So she and her indoctrinated henchmen aboard this asteroid station are trying to neutralize Shepard, and Shepard fights back, but then is knocked out by this burst of energy from the Reaper artifact. And I'm guessing you have more notes from that fight as well.
Yes. Let's see. Another slamming ass reference, an explosion. It wipes out the system, but there is still power in Omega. We learn about Project Ro, and Kinsen saw a vision like we did with the beacon. She tells the people to tidy up the lab. I don't like that. There is weariness in that man's voice. The timer has started. We have 2 days, 3 hours, and 25 minutes. The pulses are going out at a rate of the Reaper's arrival. And welcome the worst dressed person in the entire universe. That was not a good tone.
So, you mentioned multiple slamming ass references. Of course, that's because they're trying to slam an asteroid into the Alpha Relay. But there was here. I want to bring this up because this is one of those references that you were talking about. Two guards are talking about it actually on Eritot, and I think this is the first slamming ass reference. This is also a meta Mass Effect Lorecast reference, but I felt so vindicated when I pulled this dialogue line from the game. Listen to this. You ready?
They wanted to slam an ass.
We wanted to slam an ass. See, I told you guys the Batarians were trying to slam ass. And y'all laughed at me. Y'all laughed at me, and I told you.
Oh, man.
Actually, in this instance, it's the humans trying to slam ass. And before then, it was the Krogan trying to slam ass. Everybody's trying to slam ass, guys. And actually, in this instance, the Batarians are one of the people who would be the victims of said ass slamming.
Yes. Yes, they would be. Oh, man. Okay. So then I get to Ro is just a blooming onion. What's up with that? Kinsen also had the vision along with other people on there, but it was not like the beacon at all. Very, very different. Damn it, my indoctrination radar is broken. Maybe I am indoctrinated? What episode is this? Uh-oh, not good. Who is the voice actor of Ro? It sounds very Savvy. Even Naked Shepard is a badass. Now the timer is less than 2 hours. I was knocked out for 2 days. That sucks. Where's Garrus?
And that's right, and Shepard gets where's Garrus? I love that reference. 2 days later, that's when Shepard wakes up, has to fight through all of these waves of indoctrinated, totally not Alliance personnel to regain control of the asteroid and then send it crashing into the Alpha Relay. Ultimately, you do, but you can't warn anyone on the planet of Aritot or any of the Bahak system's planets. And I feel like this is really the hardest part about this DLC, that you cannot have your cake and eat it too. You have to carry out this mission in order to blow up the Alpha Relay, because that will delay the Reaper's arrival. But to do so, you will be dooming 300,000 people, more than that, on Aritot, and more than that across the Bahak system's planets. I think there's some secondary stations. And that's really messed up. You can't even warn people and tell them to evacuate or get to shelter or something.
Yeah. That was really, really rough. It's not even like, it's such a rough decision. And as soon as you make it, it's so fast. Shepard hits the button without hesitation. And I'm like, it seemed too quick for me. I needed an additional moment's pause in order to see her or to see Shepard hit the button so easily.
Well, Shepard literally didn't have time. Right. I think there was like, what, 20 seconds or something like that, or something like that. It was very, very close, I believe.
No, we have a lot more time left. Because we have an hour and 55 minutes of when they wake up. But up next, I have a data log of Kensen is acting a data log of a guard. And it reports out that Kensen is acting odd. And I can't tell if the Reapers are fearful or hopeful. Like the tone of her voice, I can't tell if it's fear or hope. I believe I sent you this audio clip if you wanted to play it. Fear or hope?
I actually can't bring up Discord right now because if I do, it's going to bring down our videos. I tried to do that a little bit ago. And if viewers are confused, like, hey, what was that gray squares we saw on the video? That's why. I don't know why that happened. Been a while since I've streamed, so maybe I need to update some software. But yes, it is a great audio clip that kind of illustrates the depths of her indoctrination.
Yeah, I can play it.
Kensen's acting strange lately. Like she doesn't care about the project anymore. I know I'm not the only one having those dreams. The Reapers are coming, she says. But I'm not sure if I'm hearing fear or hope in her voice.
Yeah. So there we go.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's like, wow, okay, how did no one kind of sense this getting out of hand before that log was taken? And why did no one relay this up the chain of command, ultimately perhaps to Hackett? Or maybe they did, and Hackett was aware but thought that Kensen could pull it off before indoctrination would take hold. Who knows? But ultimately, we do fight through all these waves. We do crash the asteroid into the Alpha Relay. It blows up. But right before then, right before we get off the station, off the asteroid and out of harm's way, we get this awesome one-on-one conversation with Harbinger. And it's right at the end of the DLC. Here it is. Let's take a listen right now.
Shepard, you have become an annoyance. You fight against inevitability, dust struggling against cosmic winds. This seems a victory to you, a star system sacrificed. But even now, your greatest civilizations are doomed to fall. Your leaders will beg to serve us.
Maybe you're right. Maybe we can't win this. But we'll fight you regardless. Just like we did Sovereign. Just like I'm doing now. However insignificant we might be, we will fight, we will sacrifice, and we will find a way. That's what humans do.
Know this as you die in vain. Your time will come. Your species will fall. Prepare yourselves for the arrival.
He said it. He said arrival. So that has to be perhaps the only conversation in which I have been intimidated by Harbinger. Sovereign, Mass Effect 1, one of the most intimidating villain reveals of all video game time for me. But Harbinger never really intimidated me until that moment. Know this as you die in vain. It's like, whoa, holy crap. Not only is it his goal to defeat us, it's his goal to demoralize us.
Yeah. Sovereign is scary. Sovereign is intimidating. Harbinger, he's a cute little Harby. I mean, he's just a little collector boy. But this version of him, okay, now I can see the Reaper behind you. Because, like, we forget the fact that Harbinger is a Reaper. He just tends to project through other indoctrinated creatures.
Yeah. And part of this might go back to that detail we learned when I talked to Zachariah Scott, who worked on the Mass Effect team, was integral in Mass Effect 2 and 3 in the cinematics team. If you remember that interview we did in the Lorecast, he actually told us that they got pretty far in development on Mass Effect 2 before they realized that they didn't actually have, like, a main villain. And that's when they invented Harbinger. So it might be that we got a little bit more of this kind of insidious Reaper background for Harbinger in the DLC, in the Arrival DLC specifically, because he came so late in the development process. Maybe we would have gotten more of that kind of thing throughout the game if he had been created earlier.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right.
So, asteroid crashes into the relay. It blows up. Boom. Reaper's arrival is now delayed, but at the cost of the entire system, right? And that's about 300,000 plus dead, mostly Batarians. And Hackett is understandably pissed off when he meets us on the Normandy afterward. Let's go ahead and take a listen to this cutscene. Hackett coming on board the Normandy SR2, the Cerberus vessel, to talk to us and debrief us. Listen to this.
All I know is I sent you out there to break Amanda Kenson out of prison. And now an entire system is destroyed. I hope you could fill in the leap of logic between those two events.
I confirmed Dr. Kenson's proof. The Reapers were coming, and destroying that relay was the only way to stop them. Kenson sedated me for almost 2 days. I started the engines with little more than an hour left. I tried to warn the Batarian colony, but time ran out.
The Batarians report no survivors from Aratat. At least you tried. And you believe the Reaper invasion really was a threat?
No doubt about it. We literally had minutes to spare.
I'm sure all the details are in your report. I won't lie to you, Shepard. The Batarians will want blood, and there's just enough evidence for a witch hunt. And we don't want war with the Batarians. Not with the collectors out there taking our colonists.
What are you saying?
You did what you did for the best of reasons, but there were more than 300,000 Batarians in that system. All dead.
They died to save trillions of lives. If I could have saved them, you bet your ass I would have.
You're preaching to the choir, Commander. If it were up to me, I'd give you a damn medal. Unfortunately, not everyone will see it that way.
Okay, so I'll stop it right there. Because in like 1.5 minutes, Hackett went from, what the hell happened out there, Commander, to, hey, listen, buddy, if it were up to me, I'd give you a damn medal. Maybe you should have killed more Batarians. I don't know. Just putting that out there. Like,
yeah, it was a very quick flip. I was not expecting that because I was like, uh-oh, I'm in big trouble, but I have a couple of months until I need to react to this.
This is like immediately afterward, and Hackett is well aware that what just happened could very well ignite a war between the Batarians and humanity. So he's surprisingly cavalier about it. I get it, you need a beat change for a story, like in meta reason. I totally get that. However, this is really quick, and it also kind of paves the way for how this is going to be received, and it cements some of my other opinions about Shepard being a scapegoat here. And we can get into that in a little bit after this. However, I did want to bring up the fact that this DLC delivers us a rare glimpse of internal Batarian politics. Which is this culture of fear that their government fosters, and the Cold War-esque kind of conflict that still exists between the Batarians and humanity. And this is exactly what Hackett is getting at here, why this situation is so extra sensitive. I mean, it would be sensitive if you blew up 300,000 of anybody, but this is like a powder keg. And so check out this codex entry from the DLC. It's pretty long, so we'll take turns going through it right here. But first part says, quote-unquote, nothing is impossible, says the hegemony propaganda poster that depicts a muscular Batarian miner under an Aratat sky, his rebreather held away from his face as if he's just taken it off. The image sums up millions of man-hours of labor on the Batarian planet and represents, or misrepresents, much of its history. 2 decades ago, Aratat, like several planets in the Skillian Verge, was claimed by both human and Batarian governments, but the Alliance backed out after learning about the atmosphere's dangerously low pressure and oxygen levels. Instead, they concentrated their colonial efforts on planets that could support human life without the aid of domed habitats and rebreathers. Human governments saw it as a wise move. Batarians saw it as cowardly.
Oh, okay. So I don't mind at all that the Batarians took a planet that they could work with. I don't agree with it when a colonizing a planet removes native species or peoples already living there. But this was uninhabited, and they had the means to make it work for them. Like, okay, Batarians, you can have this planet.
Yes, and in fact, it looks like they put in more of the effort, whereas the human colonizers kind of withdrew. They didn't feel like it was going to be a good return on investment, apparently. However, as the Codex kind of labels here, it says that the image sums up millions of man-hours of labor on the Batarian planet and represents or misrepresents much of its history. So there's more to go here in this Codex entry, and why don't you go ahead and read it for us, Jen?
Yeah. The Batarians rose to the colonization challenge, shipping in large numbers of laborers. They took the high financial costs and casualties due to accidents or logistical snafus in stride. Large-scale dumping of cyanobacteria has increased the oxygen in the atmosphere by a fraction of 1%, a modest increase that the hegemony trumpets as a sign of their eventual victory. Short-term profits on Aratat are largely made in the minerals sector through mining the extremely metal-rich planetary crust. The dark side to the mining does not appear on the propaganda poster. The majority of laborers are indentured servants or slaves.
Okay, OSHA be damned. This whole planet sounds like it is a workers' comp paradise, if you actually have workers' comp laws in place, which I highly doubt the Batarians do, especially for their indentured servants or slaves, who, by the way, they don't have to be Batarians. They could very well be members of other races. So, of course, the Batarians are taking the financial costs and casualties in stride, as the Codex puts it, because the overhead for a slave is zero.
Yeah. I don't think that many indentured people or enslaved peoples are Batarians, because the Batarians have only, that we've seen in-game lore, have been Quarians, humans, and Salarians. I don't think we've seen Batarian slaves.
We do know from one of the comics where a Volus and a Batarian say something to Liara on Omega, that there was a huge influx of Asari, basically sex slaves, after the war on the Citadel in Mass Effect 1. So we do know that.
Oh, yay. Even more.
That's from and the comics, by the way.
This is where it lost me. The idea of profiting off of the labors of enslaved peoples is beyond words for me. If these were paid workers, contracted Batarians, even outsourced employees, that's a different story. But in this... No. Ugh.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically, that's why the Codex is saying represents or misrepresents much of Aratat's history, because it's like, yeah, you guys like threw a bunch of numbers at it, but these were people who were not exactly willing or paid workers. So do you really deserve any of the credit for throwing bodies at this problem? Anyway, the Codex entry continues and says, Aratat is rumored to have military bases on its surface and throughout its solar system, though details are heavily restricted by the hegemony's Ministry of Information Control. Well, that's very dystopian, isn't it? Ministry of Information Control. That's like the hegemony's Ministry of Pro-Hegemony Communications.
Yeah.
Man, that sounds familiar. Where am I seeing that kind of thing today? Anyway, human merchant ships rarely come to the planet, outcompeted by local companies that benefit from heavy economic protections. Okay, that's also known as a tariff. The average Aratat citizen only sees humans on the news, usually featured in stories of trials and executions of accused spies.
Fear-mongering and taught racism. Yay, she says with heavy, heavy sarcasm. And it's like, after the things that I have seen in the real world, I know that this exists, but I really wish that it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Taught racism is one of the worst things. No.
I'm just imagining, like, reading this codex, I'm painting in my mind this ironic postcard of, like, a 1940s National Park-style artwork that says, "Come to beautiful Aratat." You know what I mean? It's like, we've got slave labor, and you better not talk shit about it because the Ministry of Information Control will come after you. And then no one wants to go to beautiful Aratat, surprisingly. Because they also have insane tariffs on Aratat, so none of the merchants want to trade with them. So, and I'm not just saying that they have insane tariffs, like the Codex entry literally says, human merchant ships rarely come to the planet, outcompeted by local companies that benefit from heavy economic protections. That's what a tariff is. I know a lot of people don't understand that, but that's what it is. Anyway, with that, why don't we go ahead and go to the midbreak? Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Call of Dragons. Call of Dragons is an original, immersive, and epic fantasy world taking place in the world known as Tamaris. Team up with elves, orcs, celestials, goblins, and countless other magical creatures to build your vast army. Dive into your own fantasy city with unique decor for each faction. Arrange your city as you see fit and build the unique fantasy metropolis of your dreams. Once you leave the safety of your own city, prepare for battle alongside your scary but friendly behemoth. Command your behemoth to aid you in battle with a variety of epic behemoths scattered across Tamaris, powerful giant bears, venomous hydras, lightning-fast thunder rocks, and terrifying flame dragons. Work together with your alliance to defeat them and bring them under your command. Then unleash them in battle, and please don't forget to name them. Train up your heroes with unique skills that turn the tide of battle in an instant. Unleash powerful abilities to wipe out your opponents with a huge array of equipable magical artifacts, each with their own unique skills. Turn invisible, move at astounding speed, teleport, or heal your units in an instant. Equip your heroes with an artifact that suits their abilities, and unleash artifact skills to dominate the battlefield. Call of Dragons has true 3D terrain that shapes the gameplay. Tamaris is a land of mountains, rivers, valleys, tundra, and countless other features. Not only is it beautiful, it's also essential to use your terrain to your advantage. Build your city on a plateau to make yourself impervious to attack. Set up an ambush in a mountain valley to wipe out enemy forces, or occupy the high ground and cut all would-be invaders down to size. And that's just scratching the surface. In Call of Dragons, combat isn't a matter of numbers. With the right strategy, you can turn any situation to your advantage. All these features come together to create an incredible fantasy battle experience that allows you to wage war your way. So, if you're ready to jump into the fantasy world of Tamaris, download Call of Dragons today on PC or mobile using my link in the description or by scanning the QR code on your screen.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
We have beef, we have bacon, we have beer. The foods of my people.
Young men have funny ideas of what Asari are like. I blame the extranet and computer games.
Rex?
Shepard.
Grunt?
Shepard.
Rex? Grunt?
All right, here we are in the middle of the show. And we've got one new review from Adam D. Richter in Canada. Jen, do you want to go ahead and read this one out? It's a 5-star one on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, I can do that. Don't wait until Garrus is done his calibrations. Listen now. I recently discovered the Mass Effect Lorecast. I still have tons to catch up on, but so far I'm enjoying it with the enthusiasm of Morden performing Gilbert and Sullivan. Whenever I finish a playthrough, I feel like I have to wait about a year to play it again so that I don't remember everything. But it's awfully hard to get through that year without one of my all-time favorite series. So I'm grateful to have another way to enjoy the Mass Effect universe. Thanks to the wonderful hosts and community of the Mass Effect Lorecast. Keela Salai.
And thank you to Adam D. Richter in Canada. As a reminder, if any of you guys want to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher, I believe we've found a good aggregator that gathers all those reviews from all those different places, lets us see them. Spotify also is letting you leave comments on the latest episode. When we don't have any new reviews, I'm going to be going through our Spotify comments from the latest episode, and I'm going to be picking one to read on the show here so you can get your comments read on the show that way as well. Okay, sound effects, pop quiz. I've got a voice line for you. Genesis, are you ready? I don't know if you are. This one, this one's a curveball. Okay. I'm going to play it. Here we go.
The Alliance and Council have got their heads buried so deep up their butt puckers they can't see squat.
Please tell me you heard that.
I did.
Okay, let me one more time. I'll do it one more time. How about that?
The Alliance and Council have got their heads buried so deep up their butt puckers they can't see squat.
Oh, okay. So that sounded like Udina, but is it ME2 Udina when he's still, when he's not the leader? Oh, you may have stumped me on this one.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, finally. Finally. Okay. You want me to tell you?
Yeah.
It is Rupert. It is the cook.
It's the same voice actor. That's rude.
Got him. So it was Rupert. I believe it's one of the first conversations you have with him, if not the first. But the butt puckers, gonna be one of the most legendary voice lines from that game. So glad you liked it.
Yeah. Good job.
We've got a planet card, and you actually mentioned this, that you took note of it earlier. Aratat, you want to go ahead and read this one for us?
Sure. Like Mount Everest inside an oven, was how John Grissom described Aratat while on a fact-finding mission to see if the Garden World was worth contestation with the Batarians. His team ultimately decided that the planet's air pressure and oxygen content were too low for large-scale human habitation. Undeterred, the Batarian hegemony colonized the planet's polar regions and began an extensive terraforming effort with cyanobacteria and invasive plant species. Alliance intelligence has confirmed that the colony has several Batarian military installations, which are too close to human space for the Alliance comfort. Goes on to the Edie's Travel Advisory. The Batarian hegemony considers any presence of Alliance military vessels in Batarian space as hostile. The Normandy SR-2, while an independent vessel, strongly resembles the Normandy SR-1, an Alliance ship. Use of stealth systems is highly recommended.
So this is a total, total Cold War allegory right here. Microcosm, I guess you could say. That the Batarian hegemony's military installations on Aratat are technically within Batarian space, but way too close for comfort to human space. Sounds like the Alliance would prefer that there's some kind of buffer zone, I guess you could say. But yeah, I love this planet card for Aratat. It enlightens us as to just how tense the situation is and remains just some, you know, decades later. And it's still very much a contemporary conflict. Okay, so we also have... Oh, wait, I forgot to play...
Scans have found something.
There we go. I promised I would always play that sound effect when we did the planet cards. We do have two new patrons, Charlotte Y and Viblet. Thank you so much for the support, and a shout-out to our Tier 5s in April. William Superfly, 440, Red Trobot, Lieutenant Tosino, Kira C, Ed Boy, and Draco, and... sound means a special thank you to our Tier 6 Reaper Tier patron, Commander Shrinky Ship, who has sponsored this specific episode. Okay, and with that, let's get back to the rest of the show.
After time adrift among open stars, along tides of light and through shoals of dust, I will return to where I began.
Solarian reproduction different. Very little sex drive. If intended to try human, would try you.
Ow, my pancreas!
I will never tire of hearing that sequence of Morden and then Joker. Okay, so clearly there are some moral hangups about dooming an entire solar system and hundreds of thousands of people killed because of the decision of one commander. I think we would be remiss if we didn't like devote a specific section of this episode to not talking about those. Specifically, I wanted to discuss, is this an ends justifies the means kind of situation? Because up till this point, I kind of thought that Mass Effect's narrative largely leads us to believe that only the villains in this universe justify their atrocious behavior because the stakes are high. You know, I didn't have time. The stakes were high. I did what I had to do. That is so often a repeated justification from villains. The Elusive Man, Saren, you know, you name it, Udina. Paragon Shep, though, does things the right way or not at all. And that's why Paragon Shep advocates for destroying the collector base.
Right. Oh. Okay. So for me, I kind of want to take it just a step further back, and it's not just Shepard's decision. If Shepard was the one that set up this asteroid, if they were the one who built everything, put the rockets in place, set everything up, then that would have been Shepard's decision. It was Shepard's decision only to follow through on the plan that somebody else had already orchestrated. There was an entire base of people who believed that this was the correct action. It could have been Admiral Hackett's idea to slam the asteroid into the relay to prevent this. You know, it's not necessarily Shepard's decision and Shepard's decision alone in order to make this go through.
Uh-oh, I think we may have lost Genesis. I think the Reapers have got her. Hopefully, they will not find my studio. Okay, and she's back. I see you've defeated Harbinger yet again. Thank you. I wanted to bring up, though, you're kind of like... Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, right? So I'm playing a character. Don't get mad at me. You're kind of absolving Shepard of any responsibility that they might have for pulling the trigger on slamming this asteroid into the relay, knowing fully well that it's going to kill everybody in the system and not being able to warn them. So you're kind of absolving them of responsibility, but for our philosophy nerds out there, you're going to like this. Is it then fair to absolve the trolley operator of any responsibility for running over anybody, no matter who they divert the tracks to or keep them on the same tracks, because they didn't build the trolley tracks. They didn't tie the people down on those tracks. But they still had a choice. So is the person or people's death because of the trolley operator's fault?
Oh, okay. The trolley experiment, and it really is going back to that same idea. And no, Shepard isn't absolved of the choice that they made, but correct me if I'm wrong, are we given the choice to not launch the asteroid? Are we given the choice to prevent this in any way, shape, or form?
So this is why I'm blaming Shepard and not the player, because the player doesn't have a choice. You will lose the game. If you burn out the timer, you will lose. You cannot proceed in the game. But Shepard in universe does have a choice, right? Shepard could just say, you know what? I'm not doing this. I can't live with this. Call in the Normandy. I'm getting out of here.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be a choice. And then let the Reapers arrive early and have this cycle end. But we don't know that. We have to be thinking in the mindset of the Shepherd in that moment who doesn't know what the long-term consequences are.
True, but in the same game at the very end of Mass Effect 2, we hear a Shepherd, a Paragon Shep, say, I won't let fear dictate who I am. And that justification could very well be applied here and say, yes, true, the Reapers may enter the Alpha Relay, but we will find a way. I'm not going to let fear dictate who I am and condemn hundreds of thousands of Batarians to die, right? Of course, it's not the way that the narrative is set up. You have to play by these rules for this narrative. But I just wanted to examine this idea that is, are we kind of forced to, at least in this instance, are we as the players forced to embrace this ends justifies the means mentality? Because we have no other option as players than to do this and then to watch Shepard live with the consequences.
Yeah, we are. We are forced into this decision where what we do justifies it. The only thing that we have is whether we attempt to warn the Batarians and get them out, or we immediately try and call for our evacuation after we hit the button.
If this were D&D and Shepard was a paladin, would this be enough to break his or her oath?
Well, I mean, it depends on the oath.
Oath of what is the totally righteous, you know, lawful good one. I forget what it is.
It could if the guilt of that decision is what makes you question your faith and resolve. That's how you break an oath. If you make a decision that goes against your core beliefs, then yes.
You know what's interesting about this? You're talking about guilt. We see the representation of guilt so consistently throughout Mass Effect 3 on Shepard, and it manifests in a number of different ways in their dreams, like the Vermeier survivor, the Vermeier person who died, actually, other people who have died along the way, like Morden, but we never actually see any representation of the Alpha Relay, right?
No. And honestly, I think it's because Shepard is a little bit anti-Batarian also. Especially depending on your background, you've had some very bad dealings with Batarians in the past, and I think that might color the decisions as well.
True. I mean, I would like to think, though, that Shepard is smart enough to know that by a 2-to-1 margin, the majority of Batarians down on that planet's surface below were enslaved or indentured servants, and they didn't even want to be there anyway. Or not even Batarians, just people. So a lot of those people he died completely innocent, or he killed, were completely innocent, and may have included women and children. So, interesting, maybe it's just an oversight, right, by the animation team. They didn't think to include, you know, Alpha Relay blowing up as a representation, or maybe there is one, and I just totally missed the subtle symbology in these dreams. But another point I wanted to bring up as a moral dilemma here. The Alliance sent a deep cover agent, Dr. Kinson, to blow up the relay, knowing fully well it would likely mean hundreds of thousands of Batarians and or others dead, right? Like we just mentioned, Alliance knowing fully well that most of the people there on Artaat were enslaved or indentured servants, may have included women and children, non-combatants, innocent people. How is this significantly different than what the Turian hierarchy did with planting a nuke onto Chanka just in case.
Oh, okay.
Because their reasoning was to save the rest of the galaxy, right? In case they couldn't win the rebellion.
So we know that when Project Rose started and when they were working through this, the timer, the countdown was a lot longer. We knew that it started off, we had a big margin, and then it slowly got faster and faster, yet we knew that they were coming within 2 days of when we landed there. So I'm wondering if whoever set up this mission believed that they would have enough time before the asteroid hit in order to evacuate the system.
That's a fair point. That is a fair point, because the indoctrination was the X factor. It totally threw a wrench in the Alliance's plans, as well as Kinsen being abducted or imprisoned, rather. They didn't plan on that, I think. So that's a very fair point. But I don't know. Did we ever see evidence that the Alliance specifically had plans to evacuate people from Arrotat? Because I don't think that we ever saw any kind of confirmation of that or any kind of plan in place. Did they have concepts of a plan, maybe?
Maybe. Maybe they had the concept of it. Maybe they had the plan, too. It just never got fulfilled because indoctrination happened instead.
Right. Yeah. Let's also talk about the fact that all of this means that top Alliance brass fully understood that the Reapers presented an imminent threat, and they were willing to act unilaterally without the Council's approval, and risk a wide-scale war with the Batarians. That's how confident they were. Now think about the irony of this. Given how surprised the Alliance Defense Committee appears to be at the beginning of Mass Effect 3 when Shepard's brought hauled in and the Reapers land behind them. Why are they so surprised? Unless top Alliance brass were compartmentalizing that intelligence to the point where not even the defense committee in front of Shepard was briefed about how imminent the threat was.
Yeah, this is where it gets iffy for me, because I'm like, if this was an Alliance mission where they knew and they understood and they were willing to act on the fact the Reaper arrival was imminent, and then it's a huge shock when they get here.
And it's not like a lot of time that passes. It's not.
3 months.
Right. And in fact, 3 days, I believe it is. 3 days, not, you're correct, in months, but 3 days after arrival DLC, that's when we get the Mass Effect Conviction comic that shows us James Vega right before being tasked with guarding Shepard as prisoner. So it's very quick, these things that are moving in peace in the Alliance. So it's kind of weird. Maybe it's a plot hole, maybe it's not. But I just think it's kind of an entertaining idea that the Alliance brass were so closely guarding this secret and didn't really want to disseminate to everybody. And it would make sense, right? They wouldn't want people to panic.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but people should have been panicking the moment that Sovereign showed up on the Citadel. Like, that should have been, things should have started a lot sooner.
Yeah, the Council was remarkably effective in whitewashing that incident, right? So I would have loved to have seen more like conspiracy theorists within the Mass Effect universe who were actually right, and they were labeled conspiracy theorists because they were saying Sovereign was a Reaper and it wasn't the official story that the Council told. Anyway, that's a side note. We have a few main questions that we have to address given to us by our Reaper overlord, Commander Shrinky Shep. And this first one is really fascinating to ponder. How much did Hackett know about this project?
Well, we've kind of been talking about that throughout this whole episode, trying to figure out how much Hackett knew, how much the Alliance knew, and what was going on there. I don't think that we have a definitive answer to that.
I don't think so either. But I think that there are some breadcrumbs that we can kind of piece together to get maybe an idea. And this is a multi-pronged question. How much did Hackett know about the project? Because it also includes when. When did he know? But first of all, I think that given Admiral Hackett's position as commander of an entire fleet, and specifically, I think he commands the... He's in command over the entire Special Forces branch of the Alliance. That's just off the top of my head. I didn't check that. But if... Given those two positions, or even just his position of commander of an entire fleet, and therefore the level of security clearance that those positions would warrant, I think it's safe to assume that Hackett knew the most details of Kinson's mission of anyone in Alliance leadership, perhaps even more than Udina.
Yeah, that sounds right. I believe that Hackett would have the most, and especially if they were personal friends outside of the Alliance chain of command.
Right. And, you know, I tried to find a little bit more about Dr. Kinson. And I tried to find specifically if she showed up in other, I guess, in other, like, elements?
Media.
Yeah, media, external media of Mass Effect. And she doesn't. It's just Mass Effect 2 Arrival DLC. So it's not like we get a little bit of background that of Hackett and Kinson like we did with Anderson and, oh gosh, I can't remember her name.
Kaylee.
Yes, Sanders.
Kaylee Sanders.
So we don't get that. But I think that Hackett knew everything there was to possibly know about this project. And I think that there is a reason why Hackett didn't divulge everything right away to Shepard. The next question from Commander Shrinky Shep is, why was Hackett withholding that info from Shepard? A few reasons, in my opinion. Number one, I think Hackett had to be cagey, as I think this was a need-to-know basis, this project. Given what it entails, the imminent arrival of the Reapers, I would say it's probably one of the most classified secrets of the Alliance possible. And Shepard, having been a killed in action commander officially, but now he or she is rogue with Cerberus, Shepard just doesn't meet that criteria for need to know, and divulging that level of a classified secret to Shepard, even though Hackett knows that Shepard knows, if it could be traced back to Hackett, it would be like court-martial imprisonment. Right away.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree with that. And it still is Commander Shepard, though. Savior of the Citadel, somebody to be trusted, reliable, and really, really good with their weapon. So it's somebody that Hackett can trust to get the job done.
Yeah. Infantry Slim here in chat brings up a great point, saying that the military mindset is that the government official can bypass the Defense Council and go straight to the military and have them launch a mission. The saying, quote unquote, it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission comes into play. And I feel like that may have been what kind of spurred all of this. And in fact, when we're talking about Shepard's need to know, Hackett even tells Shepard, quote, I don't like Cerberus or the way they do things, but they brought you back. So it's a nuanced thing for Hackett, clearly. And I think Hackett needs to be a little careful with how he's relaying information to Shepard because of Cerberus. And maybe the other thing is Hackett's not entirely sure if their communication is secure.
Mm-hmm. Face-to-face is the most secure form of communication, but you're also on Edie. So whatever you said, wherever, it got recorded.
Hackett says, we're clean on OPSEC, Shep. Beyond this, I think it's clear that if certain details were too dangerous to even know, in terms of legal liability at least, then by not informing Shepard of everything, Hackett was actually protecting Shep. Because Shep may not have the same diplomatic immunity as, say, the human counselor.
True.
So, probably a lot of different layers here that ultimately led Hackett to believe that it was safer to not tell Shepard everything, despite the fact that Hackett clearly trusts Shepard. So then why did Hackett make Shepard do this mission solo?
Meta answer is because it's easier to play one voice actor than all of them.
Mm.
But in game lore, I think we need to stick to that.
Quite meta. Yeah. Okay. So in game lore. Well, Hackett tells us, here's the written explanation. Hackett tells us that the Batarians, if they see a squad of armed soldiers, they're going to kill Kinson. And he says that it's very serious. This is a very delicate situation. Shepard, you need to practice some discretion. Or not at all. So there's the possibility, I think, that Hackett doesn't actually believe that necessarily, because Hackett is wary of, again, Cerberus gaining too much intelligence on this mission. So he may not trust Miranda. He may not trust Jacob or whoever else the elusive man has had Shepard recruit. But as Hackett said, they brought you back, Shep. So, you know, I don't like them. I don't trust them. And even remember, Hackett is even wary of Kelly, because remember, he has us take that call away from the galaxy map and into our private chamber. So he's clearly cognizant of what ears may be listening.
Yeah. And bringing in any of the people that we had in Mass Effect 1, i.e. Garrus or Tally, those are alien races landing in the Bahawk system. You don't bring a Turian into Batarian space. You don't bring, you know, you don't bring a Quarian into Batarian space unless you're there to sell them into indentured servitude.
And from a meta perspective, this was a DLC that made all the difference being solo, right? Because the story of the DLC is, yet again, there's irrefutable evidence of the Reaper's imminent arrival, and the only person to see it is Shepard. Well, the only person to survive after seeing it directly is Shepard. So again, it sets up this position where Shepard, as protagonist, has to just be believed or trusted. And Shepard must be so tired of this at this point. But later, Shepard has zero witnesses who can testify to his behalf, his or her behalf, and keep him or her out of the Alliance jail, besides Hackett. So why didn't Hackett step up? And I think I've already seen it here mentioned in chat a little while ago, but I wanted to get to this point before I addressed it. Plausible deniability. That's why Hackett didn't step up. They didn't want a war, as he said. It's easier to pin it on Shep being this rogue Spectre or former Spectre, rogue former Spectre with Cerberus, a human supremacist agency. So, you know, it's this rogue Spectre with a human supremacist agency. It ain't us, right? It's plausible deniability. And that's not, like, at first I thought maybe I'm just piecing together the breadcrumbs here, but then I found this little bit in the debrief conversation with Hackett on the Normandy after the mission, and listen to this. He spells it out for us. Ready?
So what do you suggest?
Evidence against you is shoddy at best, but at some point, you'll have to go to Earth and face the music. I can't stop it, but I can and will make them fight for it.
Can't stop. I didn't expect to see you aboard a Cerberus vessel. Will
make them. I don't like Cerberus or the way they do things.
I didn't expect.
But they brought you back to life, and they're actually doing something about the state of the galaxy. I didn't expect. So for now, I can be friendly.
All right. So there we have it. Again, if you actually pick that renegade option there, you tell Hackett he should thank you. And Hackett tells Shepard that they are essentially a convenient scapegoat, who's one who's really hard to fully hold accountable because he or she wasn't really with the Alliance. So it's like pretty obvious at this point. Like, Shepard from the very beginning was an ideal candidate to carry out this mission because it provided the Alliance some cover.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it just goes to show, like, that this is why it had to be solo mission, because any other witnesses could have caused problems, and Hackett needed somebody to pin this on.
Yes. Yeah. And listen to this little bit right here about Hackett and what Hackett knows. Just listen to this. Tell me what you think.
Do whatever you have to do out here. But when Earth calls, you make sure you're there with your dress blues on, ready to take the hit. In the meantime, you keep this. I don't need to see a report to know you did the right thing.
Okay. So you get, when Earth calls, you be there with your dress blues, be ready to take the hit. Okay, Fall Guy. And also, I don't need to see this report. I trust you.
Yeah, that's not trust, buddy. That's plausible deniability. I never saw a report. I only have, you know, I don't know what happened out there.
Right. You're going to have to talk to Shepard.
Yep. Go talk to Shepard. Shepard.
So, you know, at least. Okay, so I brought up the Mass Effect Conviction comic for a reason. It's just days after blowing up the Alpha Relay, and Lieutenant James Vega is at this bar on Omega, and there's a newscast playing on TV that says, quote, "While the Citadel Council scrambles to denounce the so-called terrorist acts allegedly carried out by Commander Shepard, Batarian officials are demanding retribution. Counselor Udina has publicly denied that the Human Alliance had anything to do with the destruction of the mass relay. Batarian leaders are calling for Shepard's head." And it gets cut off because James rips the TV off the wall and smashes it.
Psycho. Get off the roids, Vega.
He's pissed off. Well, this was immediately after Fell Prime, too, so he's really pissed off. And he's not going to take anything, you know, don't talk bad about Shepard. Screech. Like, he's very upset. And he's in a very bad place. But that is the lead up to how James becomes basically the prison guard, ushering around or escorting around Shepard. So I just bring that up because it becomes very evident in the lore that Shepard is the Fall guy or gal here. But the difference is, as far as I can see, is that Shepard, if Shepard is Paragon and acts as such with Hackett, then Hackett is really affirmed in his decision to try and insulate Shepard from official consequences from the Alliance. Either way, Shepard is really free by the beginning of Mass Effect 3, but who knows how that trial may have gone.
It definitely would have been interesting to see how the trial played out. It probably would have played out very similarly to Tally's trial, and we could have argued our way to one side of a conversation or not. But it being one of the first interactions of the game, we don't have any Paragon points to cause a distraction, or we can't yell loud enough because we're not renegade enough yet.
Right. Yeah, the Reapers are already here. Bong. Windows blasted out. Anyway, we'll do the trial some other time. Gotta go. See you guys. You know, I think there could also be more, if I'm putting on my tinfoil hat, I think there could be more to Hackett's intentions. I was talking about this earlier with a friend of mine, who he said there's a theory that Hackett influences Shepard to turn themselves in after this, because Hackett knows that if Shepard does, then Shepard will successfully and safely be extracted from Cerberus's hands and be back in Alliance custody.
Ooh. Okay.
Basically, this was the safest way to get Shepard back in safe hands.
I could see that.
I can see that. I think it's a little bit of a puppet master kind of move to go to this route. Maybe that wasn't the intention all along. Maybe that's why Hackett really pushes for Shepard to just turn themselves in. Because that would also lead Shepard to being in Alliance custody as opposed to, you know, fighting against Alliance, trying to take him in. It could also be because, if you remember, I think it's from the Shadowbroker dossier where we get the emails that apparently some Alliance officers were already tracking Shepard's whereabouts and asked Hackett for permission to bring Shepard in, and Hackett just went denied.
Yeah, that's an interesting, like, what? Hackett doesn't have anything over us. Like, we're not a part of his military right now. Why do we even freaking care? Like, if I was playing, like, my full-out renegade Shepard, forget going back to Earth. I owe you nothing, you guys.
Cue the conspiracy theory that Hackett is Shepard's dad.
Or the conspiracy that they were secret lovers.
Oh, not Shacket. I don't want to think about the Shacket ship. Anyway, the last question from Commander Shrinky Ship. What happens if you don't do this DLC?
So I figured I would cover this one because it happened a lot to me. And a few things are different in ME3 if you haven't played the Arrival DLC. One, Shepard didn't blow up the Alpha Relay, clearly, but the relay was still blown up by the Alliance's 103rd Marine Division, and they paid for it. So if you don't play the Arrival DLC, the 103rd's war asset in ME3 is decreased by about 50 points, and their description changes to read, Admiral Hackett dispatched Marines to the planet Aratat to rescue a deep cover agent, Dr. Amanda Kenson. The teams were killed in an explosion that wiped out both the colony and the system's relay. The Alliance spent weeks piecing together scattered radio transmissions, learning that the Marines felt they had no choice but to send an asteroid into the relay to prevent invasion by the Reapers. While it bought the Alliance some time, the men and women lost on the mission were a severe blow to the 103rd Marine Corps.
So basically, the 103rd just has to pick up the slack from Shepard not doing this.
Yeah. And a lot more lives were lost.
And if you, it doesn't really get into it. The game kind of sidesteps this, but if the 103rd did this instead of Shepard, there goes your plausible deniability. Like, that's the official involvement from the Alliance. So I'm kind of surprised we didn't see a bigger fallout with relations with the Batarians. Granted, most of them die from the Reapers anyway, but just kind of surprised it wasn't addressed in bigger narrative terms.
Yeah, I mean, there were some minor dialogue selections are different if you kept Balak alive from the Bring Down the Sky DLC. And understandably, he's pissed about you blowing up the entire Bahawk system. But it would be that the 103rd did it, not Shepard this time.
Right, so diffusing of blame a little bit there. But, you know, Shepard's still with the Alliance, and, you know, screw you. There's also that dying Batarian, right, on the Citadel's refugee docks?
Mm-hmm. Well, with that guy, Aratat was his homeworld, so he's kind of pissed at you if you were there. He's also a terrorist and was motivated primarily by the Alpha Relay's destruction. But he's less angry directly with Shepard if you didn't do that DLC. More of general anger at all humans.
How do you normally handle that guy? Do you pull him off life support like he wants, or do you just let him suffer?
No, I pull him off.
I go back.
Yeah.
I've definitely done both.
Oh, wait, hold on. I normally give him a peaceful passing, whichever option that one is.
I'm pretty sure he wants you to take him off life support because he's suffering.
Yeah.
And I think keeping him on life support is kind of like the crueler option in this scenario. But I've definitely done both because, like you've mentioned earlier, I've definitely played a Shepard that role played that they are extremely xenophobic toward Batarians because of their past. And I think you can even set it up like Soul Survivor Colonist, right? Like Colonist Soul Survivor would be like ultimate hatred of Batarians, probably.
I think so. That sounds right.
Anderson's opening talk with Shepard is also slightly different. If you didn't do Arrival. But not that different. There's also a cool point that I found from the Art of the Mass Effect book, which is a great, great coffee table book. I highly encourage people to pick it up if you haven't. It says that the Arrival DLC was originally set in an underwater base built by humans. Shepard was supposed to land on an ocean planet and take a submarine down to the main level. What is that? That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like Leviathan DLC a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The idea at this stage was to give it a feel like the movie The Abyss, with separate containers for each section of the base. Eventually, the base was moved to the surface of an asteroid, which became a key plot point. So that's kind of cool. The plot point about blowing up the relay with the asteroid was developed after the setting of the level.
Yeah. And then they use the idea of the underwater level with Leviathan. So still keeping it very much based on, keeping it Reaper related. I kind of like the idea of an underwater level, though. Those ones are always fun.
I know. I wanted more underwater levels. There's an underwater kind of level that's added from one of the mods. You remember the LE3 Diversification Project mod? Or maybe it's Project... Oh, man, what is it called? You know which one I'm talking about. It adds a Hanar embassy. And yeah. It's kind of underwater. It's like completely surrounded by water. It's really cool. Highly encourage people to check out that mod. But yeah, that's pretty much all we have to talk about with the Arrival DLC today. We wanted to be a little bit of a supplement to the DLC. We don't want anyone... We don't want to replace playing the DLC because that is one of the best, for sure. Any final thoughts on it, Jen?
For lore, it definitely is one that you need to play through, and for continuity as well. Not having played through the Arrival DLC makes the jump from 2 to 3 a little confusing. I didn't understand why I was in jail right at the beginning of ME3. And so it made it very difficult to try and figure that out. But after getting Arrival, it made things a lot more continuitous. That's not a word.
Continuous.
So that definitely helped out with the lore of it. But definitely worth it. And it wasn't that long either. I feel like I got it done in about 2.5, maybe 3 hours. It wasn't.
I remember it being like 2 hours. So... Yeah, it's a really, really fast DLC, and like you mentioned, I think the best time to play it is right at the end. Right before the suicide mission, if you can. Yep. Or maybe after. You can play it after the suicide mission, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Well, thank you to Commander Shrinky Shep for this excellent idea on this Arrival DLC analysis. We will be back next week with the patron chat. We will see what the patrons have brought up for us to talk about this month, and then we're going to get back with more lore episodes. I think we gotta kind of, regroup, see where we want to go with the character episodes. We already talked about Arya a little bit. I think we kind of got to talk about the Talons, because we've never dedicated an episode to Nyrene and the Talons, so maybe that's what's on our chopping block. But I also know that there's more corporations for us to talk about, so we'll see what the future holds. But until next time, Spectres, I think that's all we got, so we should go. See ya. Thanks for listening to the Mass Effect Lorecast. Reach out to us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Discord, Patreon, or email us at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.
Join us next week for more lore. Same space, same time. Or check out our live streams at twitch.tv/masseffectlorecast.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It
prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.